building the Latin American drug network. The Czechoslovak component of the Soviet drug offensive began in 1960 on two fronts: Asia, Indonesia, India and Burma, and Latin America, Cuba. Because of the special relevance of Cuba to the growth in illegal drugs and narcotics in the United States, the Soviet-Czechoslovak-Cuban operation deserves close scrutiny. In the late summer of 1960, just a year and a half after Fidel Castro seized power, his brother Raúl Castro visited Czechoslovakia in search of military aid and assistance. At that time, Fidel and the Soviets distrusted each other, which is why the Cubans first approached Czechoslovakia rather than the Soviet Union. Cejna was responsible for receiving the Cuban delegation and serving as their host during their visit. One of his first actions was to arrange for Raúl to visit the Soviet Union and meet Khrushchev. Following that visit, the Soviets directed Czechoslovakia to work with the Cubans and pave the way for an eventual Soviet takeover of Cuba. The Soviets wanted Czechoslovakia to take the lead, hiding the role of the Soviet Union. They did not want Fidel Castro to be aware of the Soviet operation to infiltrate and take over Cuba, and they did not want the United States to be alerted to what would be happening. Cuba and Czechoslovakia signed an agreement whereby the Czechoslovaks would help the Cubans obtain military equipment, train the Cubans in military planning and operations, and help organize Cuban intelligence and counter-intelligence too. In return, Cuba agreed to become a revolutionary center 3 in the West, and to allow Czechoslovakia to establish an intelligence station in Cuba. 16 Czechoslovak advisors went to Cuba to provide training and help establish their intelligence and counterintelligence operations. Roughly 50% of the Czechoslovak advisors and intelligence agents who went to Cuba were actually Soviets operating under Czechoslovak cover. Within 3 years, all Czechoslovaks in key positions would be replaced by Soviets. Thus, from the beginning, Cuban intelligence and military structures were heavily influenced by the Soviets. In less than 10 years, the Soviets were in complete control. After the first Cubans had been trained as intelligence agents, they received their first directions from Moscow via Czechoslovakia to infiltrate the United States and all Latin American countries for and to produce and distribute drugs and narcotics into the United States. The instructions from the Soviet Defense Council went to the Czechoslovak Defense Council and thence to Cuba. Czechoslovak advisors helped the Cubans initiate the production of drugs and narcotics as a matter of the highest priority and also assisted them in setting up transportation routes through Canada and Mexico, where the Czechoslovaks had good agent networks, into the United States. Rudolf Barak, the Czechoslovak Minister of Interior and as such the head of civilian intelligence, personally helped establish the Cuban operation. From the beginning, Barak was constantly pushing the Soviets to go faster and farther. He wanted to speed production and make more effective use of the Czechoslovak agent networks in Latin America, Asia, Austria, and West Germany. No sooner had the basic Cuban drug production and trafficking operation started up than instructions were received from the Soviet Defense Council to expand the offensive. In 1961, Czechoslovakia received directions from the Soviet Defense Council for Cuban intelligence to infiltrate existing drug operations in Latin America and the United States, and to prepare the base for recruiting these independent operations. The order was presented to the Czechoslovak Defense Council by the Ministers of Defense and Interior. As Secretary of the Czechoslovak Defense Council, Cejna was responsible for coordinating and scheduling such directions and subsequent assignments. The Czechoslovak plan to implement the order had been coordinated and approved by the Soviet Administrative Organs Department of the Central Committee of the CPSU. The main objective of the infiltration was to obtain information on individuals who had been corrupted by drug and narcotics trafficking. Key target groups that were identified were the military, police, government, politics, religions, and business. Additional targets were scientific institutions, military industry, and universities. A secondary objective was to obtain intelligence on all drug and narcotics production and distribution activity, to enable the Soviets to exert strategic control and help prevent the various independent operations from interfering with one another. Intelligence derived from organized crime penetrations also contributed to this objective. The first meeting to coordinate the infiltration and collection of data on drug and narcotics corruption that Cejna was aware of occurred in 1962 during the Second Havana Conference, at a secret meeting of Soviet and Soviet-trained strategic intelligence agents from all the Latin American organizations. The secret meeting was managed by Cuban and Czechoslovak intelligence. Czechoslovak officials from Military Intelligence, ZS, organized the meeting. Other Czechoslovak officials attending the conference were from the Ministry of Interior, Second Administration, the KGB intelligence counterpart in Czechoslovakia, and military counterintelligence. In collecting data on individuals corrupted by drug trafficking, both those using drugs or profiting from the trafficking, the Soviets identified large numbers of people who could be bribed, who were susceptible to influence, and, most important, as Sejna elaborated, who were not concerned about the consequences of their actions. The resulting information in the dossiers provided an excellent base for recruiting agents of influence or spies. This information was also used to expose and damage the reputations of individuals and organizations considered hostile to Soviet interests. The use of corruption data for blackmail and for recruiting agents of influence is a long-standing Marxist-Leninist tactic which is used on a global scale. Czechoslovak intelligence divided its dossiers on corruption into two categories: people already in positions of power and people at lower levels who were likely to advance into positions of power. By 1967, Czechoslovak intelligence had about 2,500 dossiers on people in the first category. Their files did not duplicate the dossiers maintained by others who were active in Latin America, the Cubans, East Germans, Hungarians, Bulgarians, and Soviets, because of cooperation among the intelligence services. Thus, by the late 1960s, the Soviets already possessed corruption data on upwards of 10,000 influential people throughout Latin America. As an indication that these numbers are not unreasonable, in 1971 a Frenchman by the name of Batcaun was caught bringing heroin into Canada. He was deported to France and convicted there of exporting heroin. During the trial, Batcaun was identified as a member of the French Communist Party and an agent of the subsection Groupement 5 of the Soviet KGB. During his trial, Valers Actuels reported that when arrested he had in his possession a list of 2,000 heroin addicts in Canada, many of whom were prominent civil servants, artists, radio and television entertainers, and university professors. 6. Corruption, of course, is not confined to Latin America, but includes North America and European countries such as France, Sweden, Austria, Switzerland, Italy, Great Britain, and Germany, of which the last two were identified by the head of the CPSU's international department, Boris Ponomarev, as the most corrupt. Recognizing that the financial institutions that help launder illicit money are part of this network of corruption, the potential for Soviet blackmail and influence operations becomes mind-numbing. Indeed, as will be discussed later, part of the Soviet strategy was to involve people in drugs who were in positions of influence, especially people in banks, financial institutions, politics, the military, and middle-level management and industry, precisely because of the subsequent potential for blackmail and influence operations. 7. Knowledge of how various independent drug operations work, what their trafficking networks are, and who their contacts are, is also used in pursuit of the second objective mentioned on page 26, to exercise strategic control over the operations. In general, the Soviets do not want or need tactical, day-to-day control. So long as drugs and narcotics are flowing in the right direction, into bourgeois societies, Soviet objectives are being accomplished. What is important to the Soviets is to prevent such activities from interfering with other Soviet bloc operations, and certainly to prevent such operations from causing the spotlight of publicity to be shown in the wrong direction. The information collected via this process was impressive. In 1963, General Sejna, the Minister of Defense, and the Chief of Military Intelligence visited the ZS Drug Trafficking Training Center at Bratislava. Their host and escort was Colonel Karel Borsky, the military intelligence political officer who was in charge of the training centers. At the time, Sejna was amazed at the scope of the detail on drug trafficking around the world, but especially throughout Latin America, that had been assembled at the Bratislava training location. For example, extensive data had been acquired on numerous companies in Mexico, the main business of which was drug smuggling, including pictures of the trucks and the names of the drivers used to transport the drugs into the United States. Armed with knowledge of how drug operations work, the Soviets watch an operation and exert control only when necessary. The potential for strategic control is evident from testimony given in 1983 by Juan Crump, a Colombian lawyer and narcotics trafficker. In response to questions by Senator Dennis DeConcini, Democrat Arizona, on the importance of contacts with Colombian officials, Crump responded that contact, bribery, was essential in order to exist and survive. Through Soviet knowledge of these officials and intelligence on their illegal activities, the Soviets obtained the leverage to exert control over the independent drug operations when necessary. Another mechanism employed to deal with organizations or individuals who do not cooperate is to set them up for arrest by drug enforcement authorities. That has been rumored to be what enabled the U.S. authorities to bring to trial the Colombian drug lord, Carlos Letter Rivas. Possible reasons for his betrayal are easy to imagine. For example, either the Soviets or the other members of the Medellin cartel could have concluded that Letter had become too vocal, too political. Letter was giving radio interviews and calling cocaine the Latin American atomic bomb 10. Cocaine was a revolutionary weapon to be used against the imperialists, he explained. The problem with what he was saying was that it focused unnecessary attention on the drug operations, specifically on the Medellin cartel of which he was a member, and was close enough to the truth about the Soviet operation that either party could have concluded that Letter had to be silenced. The beauty of simply turning him over to American law enforcement authorities was that it improved the public image of these authorities, even though all they were really doing was acting as disciplinary agents for the drug trafficking organization. Another example of this practice was provided by Ramon Millon Rodriguez, a Miami-based CPA who managed a significant proportion of the drug money earned by Colombia's Medellin cartel, see page 97. While in the process of taking $5.3 million in cash out of the United States in May 1983, he was arrested and subsequently convicted of racketeering too. Rodriguez was employed by the cartel to set up safe houses for collecting, counting, and packaging the cash. He then arranged shipment of the money, a complex laundering process, to various banks. All the banks in Panama were used by Rodriguez in the process. Eventually, he explained, most of the money returned to him, which he then invested in real estate, stocks, bonds, and certificates of deposit for the cartel. When Rodriguez first set up the operation, Manuel Antonio Noriega was an army colonel in charge of Panama's intelligence service. Rodriguez testified before a U.S. Senate subcommittee in 1988 that he believed General Noriega had very adroitly used the American law enforcement agencies to surgically extract me from the operation, while leaving the operation intact for him and his cronies to continue working 13. The tip-off for Rodriguez's arrest was an anonymous wire, presumably sent by Noriega, from Panama to the South Florida Task Force on Drug Interdiction, alerting them to Rodriguez's plans 14. But there are other possibilities worth considering. Rodriguez states throughout his testimony that he was strongly anti-communist. In 1980 or 1981, Cuban intelligence, the DGI, had tried to recruit him to their operation, but he had turned them down. At about the same time, a war started between the Medellin cartel and the Cuban-sponsored M-19 revolutionaries. Rodriguez states that he advised the cartel on how to fight the war using terrorist tactics and then advised against cooperating with the M-19 after the dispute was resolved. Rodriguez further explains how he cautioned the cartel about the measures he saw being taken by Cuban intelligence to penetrate and obtain control of the cartel. Finally, Rodriguez explained how he was especially careful in his dealings with Noriega to ensure that Noriega was powerful enough to serve us, but never let him get powerful enough to control us. While the telex to Miami that triggered Rodriguez's arrest may have come from Noriega, under the circumstances, it would also be logical to suspect that a Cuban or Soviet intelligence agent might have been behind it. Through the use of information gained by infiltrating the various drug organizations, the Soviets have no need for direct, tactical control of all Latin American operations. Indeed, it is better that they maintain their distance and that even insiders should remain unaware of the leverage, control, the Soviets can exert when necessary. This operating principle can be seen reflected in a secret resolution adopted at the Tricontinental Conference held in Cuba in 1966, which stated as the sixth operating principle, to back up resolutely the campaign of the drug addicts, defending it in the name of respect for individual rights, to maintain completely apart the cadres of the Communist Party from the channels for narcotics and their traffic, so that this source of income could not be linked with the revolutionary action of the Communist Party, although we must combine fostering the fear of atomic war with pacifism and with the demoralization of youth by means of hallucinating agents, 5, emphasis added. Following the decision to have Cuban intelligence agents infiltrate all Latin American operations, The Soviet Defense Council gave further instructions, again through the Czechoslovak Defense Council, this time for Cuba to establish its own production and trafficking operations in various Latin American countries. This provided a first-level backup to the indigenous operations. Cuba now moved rapidly to establish narcotics activities in Mexico and Colombia. The resulting Cuban drug network set up in Colombia was manned by Colombians but directed by Cuba. Czechoslovak intelligence helped establish the operation and the Soviets were involved in both planning and approval. As soon as the new arrangements were underway in Mexico and Colombia, the Cubans, with the assistance of the Czechoslovaks, expanded into Panama and Argentina, and, with the assistance of East Germany, into Uruguay and Jamaica. Cuba and Czechoslovakia also developed joint operations in Chile. Danislav Lotsky, a Czechoslovak intelligence agent, was in Chile officially under an economic cover. His instructions were to develop in concert with the Cubans' production and distribution networks in Chile first, and then to expand the network into Argentina and Brazil. When Lotsky returned to Czechoslovakia in 1967, he was awarded the Order of Red Star for his successful work in building the drug network in Chile. One of Cuba's early contributions to the drug operation in Chile, identified in a U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, intelligence report, was the recruitment of the Marxist Senator Salvador Allende, who would later become president. Allende was also present at the Tricontinental Conference. He proposed creation of OLAS, the Latin American Solidarity Organization, as a united front advocating armed revolution, and was elected its first leader. During Allende's presidency, drug trafficking flourished. In 1973, U.S. authorities seized $309 million worth of cocaine produced in Chilean Laboratories 16. In Argentina, the Czechoslovak drug operation was established by one of Czechoslovakia's most successful agents, Oldřich Limbersky, who was functioning in Argentina as a representative of a Czechoslovak export company. He built the drug network in Argentina and then expanded it into Brazil. In short, the Cubans were highly effective in establishing operations throughout Latin America. Both Fidel and Raúl Castro were enthusiastic and pushed hard to have drug activities expanded faster than the Soviets deemed prudent. Fidel Castro's first visit to Czechoslovakia was particularly noteworthy in this respect. His visit coincided with an extended visit to Moscow following the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was annoyed, to say the least, and spent roughly 10 days complaining to top Soviet leaders about their general lack of consultation with him. Then he went on to Czechoslovakia. "The conversations with Fidel were most difficult," Sejna explains. Fidel thought he could destroy capitalism overnight. He wanted to exploit crime for revolution and use the knowledge of people already corrupted by drugs, which was flowing in from the Cuban infiltration operation, to help speed the sale of drugs. "The drugs will help us," Sejna recalls Castro emphasizing, "in our defense, in obtaining money, and in liquidating capitalism." Fidel was absolutely adamant. This episode, in fact, was one reason why the Soviets regarded him as an anarchist more than as a communist. The Czechoslovak officials argued long and hard to convince Fidel that they needed to prepare for the next 20 years, not just for tomorrow. It was not possible, they stressed, to change the old generation. "We can corrupt them and exploit them through crime to obtain information and to influence decisions. But the focus for significant change had to be the younger generation. These were the people that we needed to work on to change the military, to retard scientific development, and to influence government leadership. This is why American youth had been selected as the primary target for the drug offensive. To communicate Soviet drug strategy more decisively and clearly to Fidel, Czechoslovak officials organized a detailed briefing on Khrushchev's strategy of peaceful coexistence, which was designed, as Khrushchev had explained to high-level Czechoslovak officials in 1954, not to befriend the Americans, but to lead them to the grave more quickly. The whole operation was laid out so that Fidel would understand how the use of drugs was integrated into the overall strategy and, therefore, why it was not possible simply to isolate drugs and treat drug trafficking as an independent operation. Drug trafficking had been designed as an integral part of a coordinated strategy, and it was essential that Fidel understood the importance of this strategy for the long-range, systematic destruction of capitalism. In addition to production and trafficking, Cuba was also involved in research and development of new drugs. In the fall of 1963, Raul Castro's deputy went to Czechoslovakia for assistance in obtaining special equipment for producing drugs in Colombia and for manufacturing synthetic drugs as part of an experimental program in Cuba. The actual equipment was picked up by Raul Castro in April 1964, when he stopped over in Prague after a visit to Moscow. Subsequently, the Czechoslovak chief of the Health Administration of the Rear Services, Colonel General Miroslav Hemala, accompanied by two subordinates and two technicians, flew to Cuba to sign an agreement on medical cooperation, a cover for drug research, to teach the Cubans how to operate the equipment and to instruct Castro to begin local production of drugs in the Dominican Republic. This was part of the Soviet decision to produce drugs locally whenever possible, rather than ship them in from the Soviet Union or Eastern Europe. Cubans were to be used as the operators, so as to keep the Soviets clean. Following these various measures to penetrate existing drug organizations and then to set up Cuban operations throughout Latin America, the Soviets ordered the formation of still another set of backup production and distribution networks all over the region. This one organized directly by selected East European intelligence services. Czechoslovakia's first target was Colombia. To kickstart the new operation, the Soviets recommended that the Czechoslovaks should recruit one of the key individuals from Cuba's drug network in Colombia, a retired Colombian military officer who went by the name of Kovacs. The top secret code name for the Czechoslovak operation in Colombia, Pyramid, was selected to mislead people into associating the new initiative with the Middle East. The Czechoslovak officer in charge of this operation was the first deputy at the Ministry of Interior. Shortly afterwards, he became the Minister of Interior. Amazing though it may seem, some in the West do not even appreciate that in the overt communist system, the Minister of Interior is not the person in charge of natural resources or parks, which is what Westerners usually associate with the title. Rather, the Minister of Interior is in charge of interior security, that is, civilian intelligence, and the secret police. Kovacs traveled to Czechoslovakia in April 1964 with a plan for the new operation to be approved by Czechoslovak intelligence. To cover his trip, he first went to Mexico, where he was provided with a forged passport at the Czechoslovak embassy. From Mexico, he flew to Vienna, where he was provided with a Czechoslovak passport to use on the third leg of his journey. The final plan that he brought with him for the new activities in Colombia was first taken to the Soviet Union for approval. Then the plan, modified to incorporate last-minute Soviet suggestions, was presented to the Czechoslovak Defense Council. The plan set forth guidelines and planning estimates, the most important of which were: 1. With help in obtaining the necessary equipment, production of cocaine would begin within 6 months. 2. The distribution network would be in operation in less than 6 months. 3. Initial distribution would be into the United States and Canada. Later, the distribution would be extended to Europe. 4. Distribution would be kept out of the local market. At the presentation of the Joint Ministry of Defense and Ministry of Interior plan, the Minister of Defense explained that 12 people had already been recruited for the operation and that 8 of them had already been cleared in two ways. First, by the Communist Party of Colombia, and secondly, by a longtime Czechoslovak intelligence agent, who was then a high official within Colombia's Internal Security Ministry. The plan was unanimously approved by the Czechoslovak Defense Council. Because the most effective Cuban drug operation was developing in Mexico, the Soviets now directed the Czechoslovaks to infiltrate and gain control of this operation. The Czechoslovak top secret code name for this operation, Rhine, was selected to mislead people into associating it with Europe. The Czechoslovak agent who was responsible for this initiative, Major Jidrich Strnad, had been operating in Mexico under cover of an export company. His ZS control officer was Colonel Borsky. The Cubans had been especially effective in recruiting Mexicans to establish production and distribution networks and in using the associated corruption information for blackmailing Mexican officials. The Soviets were especially impressed, and one of the main reasons for directing Czechoslovak intelligence to infiltrate the Cuban operation was to learn the secrets of their success in Mexico. Recognizing the strategic location of Mexico, the Soviets further directed the establishment of a second Czechoslovak operation in Mexico, which was designed to complement the Rhine initiative. The codename of this second operation was Full Moon. This drug campaign had two purposes. The first was to develop an extensive network for smuggling drugs into the United States. The second was to train intelligence agents who would then be inserted into the United States and Canada, with instructions to penetrate drug distribution networks. Through their contacts into supply networks in Mexico, they were to access the supply network and gradually take control of the drug businesses in the United States and Canada. This was a push-pull drug operation. The name Full Moon referred to the time when Soviet bloc agents would be in control of most major groups in the United States and Canada. Mexico, it should be noted, has also been an important country in the Chinese drug offensive. With both the Soviets, initially through the Cubans, and Chinese having targeted Mexico, it comes as no surprise that Mexico is one of the primary drug trafficking routes into the United States for heroin, cocaine, and marijuana. For identical reasons, Canada is another primary drug trafficking route into the United States. Czechoslovak intelligence was also involved in the Cuban operation in Panama, under the codename Pablo. A Cuban operation was set up, too, in El Salvador. At a meeting on the financing of the Communist Party of El Salvador, Sejna remembers that the Soviets directed the Cubans to provide the financing for that party out of their profits from the El Salvador drug operation 17. A separate Soviet operation intended for the benefit of those who regularly seek the warm sands and seas of the Caribbean islands was directly targeted to take advantage of the booming Caribbean tourist trade. The second secretary of the French Communist Party, a longtime KGB agent, together with the first secretary of the Communist Party of Guadeloupe, conceived the idea of distributing drugs to Caribbean tourists. Their objectives were to raise money out of the tourist trade and to obtain blackmail information on vacationing Americans and other members of the bourgeoisie. They helped establish the operation and provided recommendations on whom to recruit to run it. The operation was then turned over to two Czechoslovak intelligence officers, one from military intelligence and one from the Ministry of Interior. Both officials had been born in France and spoke fluent French. Guadeloupe was the center of the operation, which serviced Martinique and other islands. The monies earned in the late 1960s from this initiative proved adequate to finance all communist intelligence operations in Guadeloupe, Martinique, Suriname, Haiti, and most of France. In the early 1960s, the Soviets were rapidly building organizations throughout North, Central, and South America and the Caribbean. Other Soviet satellites directly involved as Soviet surrogates, in addition to Czechoslovakia and Cuba, were Hungary, East Germany, Bulgaria, and Poland. Understandably, most of Sejna's knowledge was of the Czechoslovak dimension of the drug strategy. The other East European satellites identified above are not dealt with in detail in this analysis, but they were all deeply involved in the Soviet drug offensive. Romania and Albania were not part of the formal Soviet-directed offensive because the Soviets did not trust their security. Albania had asked to participate, emphasizing its strong intelligence network in the Balkans and the Middle East. But rather than bring Albania into the operation, the Soviets decided to provide Albania with the money to purchase the necessary equipment, so that Albania could proceed as an independent drug promoter. Countries where Sejna had direct knowledge of organizations which had been established by the mid-1960s included Canada, Mexico, Panama, Argentina, Chile, Brazil, Colombia, Costa Rica, Uruguay, Paraguay, Brazil, Peru, Guadeloupe, El Salvador, the Dominican Republic, Jamaica, and quite naturally, the United States. To this list should be added countries where organized crime operations that were critical to the drug trafficking network were being developed. One example of such a country is Venezuela, which the Soviets had decided in 1960-61 to use as a center for mafia organization, operations, and money laundering in the Western Hemisphere. The drugs initially chosen for distribution were opium, heroin, morphine, marijuana, and synthetics such as LSD. While cocaine was not prominent at that time, by 1961 the Soviets, in analyzing the drug scene, had concluded that cocaine was, to borrow one of their favorite phrases, the wave of the future eight. This revelation to Sejna came during a meeting in Moscow in 1964 which had been convened to discuss and coordinate deception planning. In attendance from Czechoslovakia were the head of the military section of the Administrative Organs Department, the deputy chief of the main political administration, the deputy chief of ZS, military intelligence, and head of strategic intelligence, and Jan Sejna. The Soviets present were the deputy chief of the main political administration, the deputy chief of GRU, Soviet military intelligence, and head of strategic intelligence, and General Boris Shevchenko, the head of the Department of Special Propaganda, who ran the meeting. It was at this meeting that Shevchenko introduced the term pink epidemic. In discussing the future, he stressed the potential of cocaine. It was highly preferable to heroin, he explained, because it was so much easier to produce and because they believed that many more people could be reached with cocaine than with heroin. The Soviets were so impressed with cocaine's potential, in fact, that they spoke in terms of its becoming an epidemic, a white epidemic. To serve and extend the epidemic, Shevchenko explained that a separate production and distribution base was to be built, commencing immediately. This new cocaine operation was to be referred to by the aforementioned cover name, Pink Epidemic. In the beginning, the lead countries in establishing the cocaine production and distribution base were the Soviet Union, Czechoslovakia, and Cuba. Czechoslovakia immediately began a special technology program to develop the necessary production techniques. This operation was run by military intelligence and the health administration under the control of military counterintelligence. Necessary production experimentation was conducted at a top-secret scientific research center at Milovice. The operation was facilitated by the Cubans, who learned the crude techniques that were used in South America and then passed the information to Czechoslovak intelligence. The Czechoslovak scientists took the procedures and developed more professional mass production techniques. Thus, between 1960 and 1965, the Soviet bloc intelligence services, directed from Moscow, established drug production, distribution, and money laundering operations throughout South, Central, and North America. Only local personnel who passed stringent security background investigations were used to run the operations, which were discreetly managed by Soviet bloc or Cuban intelligence agents who, as a general rule, were specially trained in the Soviet Union. Future drug traffickers from all over the world were taught the narcotics trade in East European and Soviet training centers. Additional training centers were later established in North Korea, North Vietnam, and in Cuba. These graduate criminals became controlled Soviet narcotics trafficking agents. The initial trafficking was in heroin, marijuana, and synthetics. However, with effect from 1964, a special network was constructed specifically to serve and extend the coming cocaine epidemic. References to Chapter 3.1. For a more detailed account, see We Will Bury You, OpCIT, pages 45 to 50. Two biographies of Fidel Castro describe the problems he had obtaining military equipment in 1959 from the Soviet Union, Yugoslavia, and the United States. Some arms and ammunition were obtained from Belgium in mid-1960. The first Czechoslovak weapons arrived in late 1960. Tad Salk, Fidel, A Critical Portrait, New York, William Morrow & Company Incorporated, 1986, page 498. Peter G. Born, Fidel, A Biography of Fidel Castro, New York, Dodd, Mead & Company, 1986, pages 188 to 189. 3. Revolutionary Center is the formal designation of a region selected and then prepared to promote the revolutionary situation throughout the zone in which the center is located and to support Soviet military operations in the event of war. The basic criteria applied in establishing revolutionary centers are the need for such centers to have political influence throughout the zone, to supply revolutionary forces for deployment in other countries in the zone, to supply sabotage material for use throughout the zone, to be a center for the education of cadres, and to be directly useful for Soviet military operations in the case of global war and for surrogate forces or neighboring forces in revolutionary wars. 4. In the summer of 1963, a Czechoslovak intelligence report stated that Cuban intelligence agents had successfully penetrated 69% of the Latin American countries. In most cases, the penetration had been through Mexico. Additionally, with the help of Spanish communities, they had placed 7 agents in the United States. 5. In 1984, Clyde D. Taylor, Acting Assistant Secretary, Bureau of International Narcotics Matters, Department of State, told Congress that reports on the involvement of the Cuban government in narcotics trafficking had first reached the U.S. government in 1963. U.S. Congress, Senate, Drugs and Terrorism, 1984, hearing before the Subcommittee on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse of the Committee on Labor and Human Resources, August 2, 1984, Washington, D.C., U.S. Government Printing Office, 1984, page 41. Rachel Ehrenfeld has written that a secret drug enforcement agency, DEA, report leaked to the Miami Herald, November 20, 1983, identified 1961 as the beginning of Cuba's involvement in drug trafficking, narco-terrorism, and the Cuban connection, Strategic Review, Summer 1988, page 57. Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr. and Robert Kennedy and His Times, Boston. Houghton Mifflin Company, 1978, page 504, reports that a Federal Narcotics Bureau document of July 1961 reported rumors in the Florida-Cuban exile community that Santos Trafficante, Jr., one of the organized crime bosses with ties into Cuba who was involved in the CIA assassination operation, was Castro's outlet for drugs in the United States. Another news report stated that DEA agent Avelino Fernandez broke open the Cuban drug connection to Noriega in 1978, and that Fidel Castro was specifically identified as having been involved with drug trafficking since 1964. Michael Hedges, picture shows Castro, Noriega, Del Cid at secret meeting, Washington Post, January 18, 1990, page A5. 6. Canlan, Psychochemical Warfare, The Chinese Communist Drug Offensive Against the West, Opsit, pages 182-183. 7. Infiltrating banks and financial institutions, while important when Khrushchev was in power, was made even more important when Brezhnev became General Secretary in 1964. 8. The Cuban government's involvement in facilitating international drug traffic, joint hearing before the Subcommittee on Security and Terrorism of the Committee on the Judiciary and the Subcommittee on Western Hemisphere Affairs of the Foreign Relations Committee and the Senate Drug Enforcement Caucus, United States Senate, Miami, Florida, April 30, 1983, Washington, D.C., U.S. Government Printing Office, 1983, pages 10-26-27. 9. See Rensselaer W., Lee 3, Why the U.S. Cannot Stop South American Cocaine, Orbis, Fall 1988, page 11. 10. Interview with Carlos Lederivas, reputed Colombian drug trafficker, in Uri Arayanen et al., Hydra of Carnage, Lexington, Massachusetts, Lexington Books, 1986, pages 433-435. 11. As an example of this type of concern, the former Consul General of Panama, Jose I. Blandon Castillo, testified that we had information to the effect that the Medellin cartel was very concerned with Noriega because Noriega was being too visible. He was preventing them from what they call business, and they were trying to find a way to eliminate him. U.S. Congress, Senate, Drugs, Law Enforcement, and Foreign Policy. Panama, hearings before the Subcommittee on Terrorism, Narcotics, and International Operations of the Committee on Foreign Relations, February 10, 1988, stenographic transcript, pages 52-53. 12. U.S. Congress, Senate, Drugs, Law Enforcement, and Foreign Policy. Panama, hearings before the Subcommittee on Terrorism, Narcotics and International Operations of the Committee on Foreign Relations, February 11, 1988, stenographic transcript 1. 13. IBID, page 86. 14. It does not make logical sense for Noriega to turn in Rodriguez to gain control, because turning in Rodriguez would not accomplish that objective. If Noriega did turn in Rodriguez, therefore, it would seem logical to search for another reason. One possibility is that Noriega was simply assisting U.S. drug control operations in Operation Pisces, which was investigating money laundering in Panama, or appearing to be assisting while actually performing a favor for someone else. As in many situations, a combination of various considerations may well have been involved. 15. Canlan, Psychochemical Warfare, The Chinese Communist Drug Offensive Against the West, OPCIT, pages 48-49. Citing translations provided by Professor Herminio Portovila, former history instructor of Fidel Castro at the University of Havana. 16. Data on Chile in the early 1960s is contained in the study by Robert Workman on narcotics trafficking for the National Defense University. He writes that a DEA intelligence report dated March 31, 1982, describes a 1961 meeting of high-ranking Cuban officials, including revolutionary leader and president of the National Bank of Cuba, Che Guevara, Captain Moises Crespo of the Cuban Secret Police, and Dr. Salvador Allende, a senator and future Marxist president from Chile, to discuss establishing a cocaine trafficking network. The report was described in a Miami Herald newspaper story, And Workman writes that intelligence agents stated that the article was accurate. Robert B. Workman, International Drug Trafficking, A Threat to National Security, Washington, D.C., National Defense University, Research Publication Directorate, June 1984, unpublished. Also, as James R. Whalen reported, at the Tricontinental Conference in Havana, then-Senator Salvador Allende proposed the creation of OLAS, the Latin American Solidarity Organization, as a united front, advocating armed revolution. Allende was then elected to head OLAS. Once in the Chilean presidency, he presided over a dramatic expansion of illicit drug activity in that country. According to one source, during the final year of Allende's presidency, 1973, U.S. authorities seized $309 million worth of cocaine from Chilean laboratories. The drug trade was said to yield $30,000 per month in payoffs to the popular Unity political parties in Allende's coalition. One of the first acts of the new military government headed by General Augusto Pinochet was to crack down on the drug trade, working closely with U.S. agencies to do so. James R. Whalen, Out of the Ashes, Life, Death, and Transfiguration of Democracy in Chile, 1833-1988, Washington, D.C. Regnery Gateway, 1989, pages 227-228,592. 17. Robert Workman cited an interview with a U.S. citizen who was kidnapped and held for ransom for about 3 months by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, a Marxist guerrilla group. The victim reported as follows: the FARC, MI9, and Ejército Popular de Liberación, EPL, are all really consolidated. They are really one family controlled by Cuba. I was in their camp when a Cuban was at a blackboard instructing some guerrillas. One of the guerrillas asked him, "What happens to all of this money? You control the drug traffic, you're taking in millions of dollars, and I don't see any money in our camp. They just give us bare necessities. You get food, clothes, and shells for your rifle, and you do not get anything else." The Cuban advisor's answer was that one half of the money was being sent to El Salvador. That we are liberating El Salvador. When El Salvador is liberated, then they will turn around and, using the economies of El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Cuba, funnel funds into Colombia and help us, so we can overthrow the government here. Robert B. Workman, International Drug Trafficking, A Threat to National Security, Washington, D.C., National Defense University, Research Publication Directorate, June 1984, unpublished, OPCIT, pages 13-14, 18. Many people are surprised that the Soviets recognized the potential of cocaine as early as 1961, especially since the problems posed by cocaine did not become well known in the United States until the late 1970s or early 1980s. This can be illustrated by recalling the attitude of President Carter's drug advisor, Peter Born, who viewed cocaine as pleasurable and benign and could not understand why DEA was making such a fuss over the increase in cocaine trafficking. The Yale University psychiatrist and drug historian David Musto has reminded us, however, how easily we forget. Early in this century, he explains, cocaine was legal and its use began to grow. Prices fell, and sniffing, swallowing, and injecting of cocaine became widespread. By 1910, cocaine had been transformed from a miracle drug to the most dangerous drug in America. In his annual message to Congress that year, President William Howard Taft said, "Cocaine is more appalling in its effects than any other habit-forming drug used in the United States." Constance Holden, Past and Present Cocaine Epidemics, Science, December 15, 1989, page 1377, citing David F. Musto, The American Disease. Origins of Narcotic Control, New York, Oxford University Press, 1987,